This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about poetry and writing as a factor in mental health and so much more with incredible poet Miss Yankee, who is someone I've looked up to for a while. And I don't have an answer for why we're only just getting around to me arranging this collaboration now. And she's connected to a wonderful group of people who have already been on the podcast, including Fiske, Anna Sinsky, and MEP. Fiske, of course, is the creator of Mind Over Matter events. And today we're actually going to be sharing a clip from Miss Yankee performing at one of them. And so that's a connection between them and the other two guests I mentioned. And so, yeah, continuing the dynasty of incredible spoken word and poetry artists from London. And so with that said, I'm not going to give too much of a preview into today's conversation. We got into a lot, and it was a wonderfully reflective conversation that I know both of us will take a lot away from. So I love the chat. I love her work. She's incredible. Please enjoy this conversation with Miss Yankee. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Okay, so my name is Miss Yankee, and I couldn't tell you when my earliest connection or knowledge of what mental health means is, because it was never off the table in my household for conversation. My parents actually met in a mental health institution. They were both training to be mental health nurses, and both of them spent their entire careers working within the mental health sector. So it was never sort of a taboo. It was never something we didn't discuss. We knew what mum and dad's jobs were. And over the years, they worked in different sectors, dad working with young people and in the youth sector, and my mum working as a community mental health nurse. So we were aware of everything from depression to anxiety to eating disorders. So I would say there was always compassion for mental illness talked about in our household, which is great, because growing up, it allows you as you start to experience your own mental health battles, but also encounter people that are going through it. I always felt like I was at least a little bit better positioned than most to have some empathy and compassion and understanding for people going through it. Yeah.
I love that. That makes me so happy to hear. And, you know, that is not, as we know, the majority of people's experiences. And if I may give you an off-the-wall take on it, one of the first things I thought of was, there is yet another argument that I've never thought of for more jobs in mental health, because then it will mean more parents out there that understand and have that firsthand experience of looking after people with issues like these. Was that also something you were able to see reflected in how they treated family and friends?
Yeah. I mean, everyone's human, right? So my experience in childhood, I'm the eldest of four children. I experienced, my dad was quite a formidable character to me growing up that commanded a huge amount of respect, but a lot of that was through fear, you know. So, yeah, I definitely experienced struggles through my childhood of having that juxtaposition of parents that work in mental health doesn't necessarily mean that you can apply that and you're doing your job at home, you know? So I certainly wouldn't say that things were terrible. But yeah, my experience in childhood wasn't always positive. Yeah.
No, that's very fair. And I come from having two doctor parents who, if you ask them, they'd say, oh, we deal with mental health every day. But they've never been in mental health specific roles. And so, you know, sometimes it wasn't the area of healthcare they were most primed to kind of talk about. And there were, you know, so often other people that those issues were dealt with within their environment. And for you, when you kind of look back on those experiences, how did you balance that contrast, that having a formidable father, but also kind of having that understanding? Did it ever make you feel like mental health issues are something that, you know, are serious and important to acknowledge and get support for, but maybe there's not entirely the space in the same way for, you know, you to struggle?
I learned to suppress.
That's what I was wondering. Yep.
Yeah, I learned to suppress. And I think there's something to be said. I mean, my parents were working with people with very acute mental illness. So I guess growing up and certainly getting into my teens, I didn't recognise what I now know to have been anxiety or depression, to have been those things. And in fact, maybe sometimes knowing the severity of the kind of patients my parents were working with almost made me downplay my own experience with mental health, because I didn't see what I was experiencing as particularly serious comparatively. So yeah, a lot of depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's tough. What do you remember of realizations around that, getting to understand what that is?
So I didn't recognize it until my early 30s. I didn't actually sit down and think about my experiences or quote unquote symptoms as coming under the label of anxiety or even depression. I spent the first half of my 20s in a very controlling and abusive relationship, which again, I didn't acknowledge, or I didn't see that as domestic violence or abuse. I just saw it as a volatile relationship and being in a relationship with someone who had anger problems and issues and trauma, and made a lot of excuses for my perpetrator. And it wasn't until I fell pregnant with my twins that I thought, something's not right here. Or whether that's mother's instinct that took in all that protective mode. But yeah, it was after I'd left my partner, but found myself still connected to him through children, that I actually got some professional help. And in that process of having that support, Women's Aid were incredible. I did something called the Freedom Programme, which changed my life, to be fair. It allowed me to understand what I'd been through, first and foremost, as a young adult. And of course, you get into therapy eventually and you unpack all of that. And then you start to look at, well, how did I get here? How did I allow myself to normalize these behaviors and to normalize being treated in such an abominable way? And as you know, with therapy, you always end up going back and reflecting on childhood. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until I reached my early 30s that I really started to kind of untangle the web of my own mental health and start to look at, oh, actually, those symptoms of anxiety, now that I've had that label attributed to these symptoms, I recognize those symptoms from childhood. As I said, things were suppressed for a long time. And the longer you tend to suppress them, when they do start to come up, oh, it's a little chaotic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And would you mind sharing, if people are unfamiliar with the Freedom Project, a bit more about that?
Yeah, so there's a book called Living with the Dominator, which was written by a woman called Pat Craven. And this book details, I guess, the tactics of a perpetrator. And it was wild to me when I got into it, because I didn't know what emotional abuse was. I didn't really understand financial abuse. So this book breaks down the tactics of perpetrators through the different characters: the bully, the persuader, the bad father, the head worker. And underneath each of these characters, it talks about the tactics that they use to maintain power and control. So essentially, it gives you an understanding as to how domestic violence works from the viewpoint of understanding what the perpetrator does, not necessarily so much why, but it really allows you to process things that have happened to you that perhaps you never, ever linked to domestic violence or even saw as acts of violence or abuse. Incredible book and such an incredible program. I would highly recommend it.
Yeah. And this is something that I really hope we kind of continue to see more of as parenting and understanding of mental health evolves, is an acknowledgement of how broad abuse can be. You know, even things like coercive control are still only in the very early stages of understanding within like professional bodies out there to look after people. And yet, certainly in my own life, I've never come across an abusive relationship where coercive control wasn't a part of that, you know, and that's been, having been in a relationship like that myself, that was part of that as well, where if, you know, if people aren't familiar, these are tactics of controlling someone in a way that are subverted. So maybe they're kind of framed as kindness, or gaslighting can be part of this, or things like using money as a way to control, using being in charge of all the household bills, being, you know, in charge of certain things with the kids as a form of control. There's so much that comes under this.
Yeah. And it can be incredibly subtle.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you actually do the work to get underneath what the hell is coercive control, what does it look like, it will go unnoticed. And it does go unnoticed. And even when you notice it, it can be very, very difficult for professionals to understand and see it. There's still huge issues with the justice system and the courts, despite it now being a crime and acknowledged as a crime and a criminal offence. It's still very, very hard for a lot of judges to get their heads around it. A huge amount of training is needed, not just around coercive control, but around domestic violence itself. There is not a trauma-informed response or handling of victims of domestic violence in the justice system. And fundamentally, that does come down to a huge lack of understanding for the dynamics of what domestic abuse looks like outside of the stereotypical, you know, guy in a white shirt that drinks and beats his wife and this stereotype we have of domestic violence that you might see in a movie or that you might have known. It goes so much further than that.
You know, and I don't think it's reductive to say that so much of that is enabled by tactics like coercive control. Because, you know, I do come across conversations where people will be like, no one could ever lay their hands on me. And, you know, it's a lot easier to say when you've not been in that position, because there's generally a lot that leads up to that, or there's a lot in your history that might contribute to certain things being normalized for you. And, you know, I'm so glad to have more conversations like this where this stuff is stamped out, because what a lot of it comes down to is so often we're not raised to know how we should be treated. And that seems like such a massive gap. And sometimes it is the smallest things, like my counselor was really clued into, for example, how people acknowledge body autonomy within kind of media, within households. You know, so for her, she raises her kids that people should ask your permission to give you a hug.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's such a simple thing to do. I feel really strongly about that with my own children, just that their boundaries are respected.
Because we can all, you know, we can all think of it in terms of, oh yeah, there was that auntie that would squeeze our cheeks and we hated it. But there is a bigger conversation there. You have the right to not be touched unless you're happy with that. And, you know, we see the extremes of when that respect isn't there. And, you know, we have to learn that stuff for ourselves. And I think a lot of the time, unless we learn this from a young age, we're going to learn when we've already been the victim of a lot of types of abuse.
And I just think education, especially around abuse and relationships, it would save so, so much trauma. I've been blessed to do some work with a young people's charity called Youth Realities. and they specialise in supporting young people who have had domestic violent relationships, abusive relationships. And the work that they do within the sphere of actually educating these young women about what red flags are, what abuse dynamics are, I think, oh, I wish that I'd had that education in my teens. I had no idea what a red flag or a green flag was. I didn't know. And something as simple as that would have allowed me to go, this is not okay. But instead, I was, of course, the people pleasing, make excuses for fixer and healer. And having that mindset allows you to turn a blind eye to just how poorly you're being treated. You know, it allows you to excuse a lot of behaviour because you cannot attribute it to what it in fact really is, which is abuse.
The priority is, how am I acting all the time?
What did I do? How can I fix it?
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of self-blame that can happen, that feeling that you need to be responsible for other people's feelings, which you're not. And so often that is disproportionately a burden placed on women. And, you know, it's good to see that terms like red flags, as much as it can be used as a colloquialism these days, it is a part of the conversation in a way that it wasn't 10, 20 years ago. And, you know, this stuff is definitely evolving. And what you're really highlighting is how important preventative measures are. Because so often the criminal justice system fails victims of abuse.
I've seen it so many times. I support a lot of women. I'm now in a phase where I'm long past survivor. You know, I'm thriving now and I'm really proud of that. But I do find myself supporting other women. I don't know many women that haven't had some kind of experience of abuse or harassment. And seeing people go through the justice system who are dealing with the most horrendous trauma are still in that mindset of trauma sometimes when they go into the justice system, and to know that that's not acknowledged at all. Yeah, it's very, very, very frustrating. It angers me greatly. Our justice system is failing and not enough people want to talk about it. And when you do, it's definitely something that is minimised, excuses are made for it. There's an incredible woman, Dr. Charlotte Proudman, who is known as the feminist barrister. Very controversial at times, but the work that she is doing around domestic violence and the justice system is just incredible. So yeah, I would thoroughly recommend going and taking a look at her work to anyone that's interested in really understanding the dynamics from a professional's point of view. She's in the justice system, she's witnessing it, and she's far more well-versed and clued up than me.
But that's it. You don't need to know all of the law to see that there's such clear issues there. Like something I've talked about before on the show is, I would love to see a different approach, a separate approach when it comes to cases of relationship abuse of any kind. So often when cases of particularly sexual violence do go on to prosecution, it is not the basis of the testimony alone. It is because there is physical evidence, whether it's, you know, DNA, whether it's CCTV. It's never only one person's word against another when it becomes a successful prosecution. And therefore, why is it necessary to have an opposing legal professional cross-examine someone that's been through trauma, who may well be dealing with things like PTSD, which can make it very harmful to them to have their experience questioned in an aggressive way, in a way that is designed and trained to try and undermine that person and trick them up and make them question their own reality. I don't see why that is necessary in that way. There are other ways maybe we can approach it.
Yeah, there's some parameters, but I mean, when it comes to cross-examination, I mean, I've been supporting a sister recently who has been in the family courts with her perpetrator. He chose to represent himself, which meant that she was cross-examined by her perpetrator.
How the fuck is that allowed?
Yeah.
So infuriating.
I understand the need for cross-examination. However, things like that, being cross-examined by your perpetrator, that alone, imagine having to sit and the very person that has caused you the trauma that you're in court about gets to question you. And in this instance, he had over 100 questions. The judge actually reduced and threw out a lot of the questions. And his sole aim was to hope that she would unravel on the stand.
Well, it sounds like his hope was that he could abuse her within the court process, which we know abuse through the courts is a very common thing, you know, particularly family courts, for example. And it's just so clearly dangerous. This is someone who, let's say, I don't know this case, but let's say he had been gaslighting her as part of the abuse. He could attempt to do the same in the court. So this is someone that she's already been vulnerable to gaslighting from, who's already caused her harm, and he could further harm her in the same way he's been successful with previously.
Well, that's pretty much exactly what happened. And it's interesting, you said, you know, when a case goes to trial and there's evidence, another person that I know, a couple of years ago, I found myself in court supporting a friend. The mum had suffered an attempted rape and somebody had broken into her house. Thank God her family were there and he wasn't able to perpetrate the crime in full. But evidence-wise, there were partial footprints. There were fingerprints on the outside of the window. There was a bottle of alcohol with his DNA on it. There was CCTV of this person at a local petrol station. There was so much evidence outside of the victim's statement and additional witness statements of people that were in the house. And, you know, it took two trials to get a conviction, despite all of that evidence, because this perpetrator said, no, it wasn't me. I came across somebody that was locked out of their house and I helped them get in. And that was enough for a jury to come back with an inconclusive verdict. So that victim had to then relive her trauma twice. So not only was cross-examined in this first court case with the evidence, had to then go back and relive it all again. So when we ask, why don't people report these things? Why don't people go to the police? This is why. Because they're re-traumatised through the courts and the conviction rates, even with evidence, are very low, which is sad, which is very, very sad.
And with what you bring up there about the jury, it really does bring me back to believing women. And why is that still such a difficult thing in this day and age? And I still have conversations with men where I'm surprised that things I find to be quite basic still aren't understood. For example, when you talked about so many women in your life having experienced abusive relationships, you know, and it got me thinking about how I don't know any women in my life who haven't experienced some kind of abuse. So let's say we use a broad example of being touched sexually in a club without your consent. I've had enough of those conversations with the women in my life. I don't know who hasn't had that experience. Maybe if you've never been to a club, that's maybe the only guarantee. And yet sometimes people can still want to come back with, oh, is that exaggerated? Are you sure? And it, you know, it's terrifying. And unfortunately, it's with women as well. You know, there can be this internalized misogyny, the explaining away behaviors like you've described. And so even then, whatever the gender of the perpetrators can be, internalized misogyny can then be a factor in explaining it away, because whatever the threat behavior can be explained away, often via the lens of aggression being justifiable, abuse being excusable, coercive control being unprovable, I'm doing air quotes, or, you know, exaggerated, more air quotes.
I don't doubt that a lot of that stems from internalised misogyny. However, we as women know, we all know a woman that's been through abuse and that's spoken out. And we know what happens when you speak out about abuse or when you become a victim. Historically, any woman that doesn't fit a societal norm or that dares to speak up against abuse or against men, you're a man hater, you're crazy, you're hysterical, you're a liar. And there are so many negative labels attached to women who either identify as victims or dare to speak up that I think a lot of women just don't want that smoke. They don't want it.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And even I would say a lot of that is intertwined, because there can be times when certain messages within that you might genuinely believe. Like, you know, oh, maybe I do hate men. To me, that will be maybe a symptom of the internalized misogyny that can come in, right? Of I should be excusing this behavior.
You know, I think a lot of women have just lost hope that they will be believed. And the other thing I wanted to say, actually, is there is a difference between acknowledging that you've been a victim of something and having a victim mentality. And often when you acknowledge or talk about something that you've been through as a victim, then people will be like, oh, well, that's a victim mentality. And you just, and sometimes, no, it's not. Sometimes it's just wanting to say out loud, this happens to me and it wasn't okay. And to be able to express that without being labeled or attacked. And it isn't a safe space for women. I don't feel that that women feel particularly safe in expressing their traumas and their abuse. And until we have a safer environment for people to be able to speak up and be believed, I mean, even with evidence, women are not believed. So what hope has a woman got that's been going through all of this and there's no evidence? What are the chances of her being believed? Slim to none. So why say anything? In which case you internalise and you suppress this trauma, and that has a devastating impact on your mental health.
And also availability of support beyond the justice system. That whether it's that it fails you or whether it's that it can't provide you the justice based on the evidence available, there's so many other forms of support that should be more available.
Well, I want to, and I'm maybe going slightly off topic, but in terms of seeking and getting mental health support post-abuse, and I never talked about this actually, but when I realised, oh my gosh, this has happened to me, I should probably go and get some support. I was offered, I think, 12 sessions of CBT, which has its uses. And then as we got to the end of those 12 sessions, I remember them doing you have these scores where you go through and they ask you, you know, out of 10, would you say that you have this? And they go through like a list of symptoms, essentially, and tick them off. And I remember very vividly being told, essentially, oh, well, you're rating high on this PTSD score. You should get some support for that. But we can't give that to you because it's not severe enough for you to be referred on to see a psychologist.
Hold on.
But it's too...
What?
Yeah, and, I'm serious.
And who... No, I believe you. I'm just baffled by what they were saying to you. Who was it that did the checklist was with you?
Psychologist or psychiatrist? I'm not sure what the qualification was, but it was the person that was offering me the CBT therapy. As we'd gone through that therapy, clearly had recognised additional symptoms, had essentially opened that can of worms for me of this is PTSD, and then left me with said can open and no additional help.
And from what you've described there, it sounds like that person wasn't in the position to diagnose. And therefore, it's a very strange position they'd put you in where they're like, oh, we're seeing some signs of this, but we can't diagnose you and without...
So recognised those symptoms in me. It wasn't so much about the diagnosis, it was the treatment for that wasn't available for me.
And, you know, we sort of touched on an interesting conversation off air about the nuance of how there's absolutely a need for like mental health support for those who have been victims, but then also that not extending in a way that is stigmatizing, whereby like explaining away your experience via mental ill health. There's a massive difference between you went through something traumatic, you deserve support, and maybe because of some issues you have, is the story all that you're saying it is?
Oh yeah, let's go there.
I'll let you pick that up how you want to.
Something that has only really come to my attention recently, and I'd never ever considered it before I met and have been lucky enough to share a stage and work with an incredible psychologist called Dr. Jess Taylor. And this is really important, how pathology is used against victims of abuse. Now, pathology, I mean, I'm sure most of your listeners do understand what that word means, but the dictionary definition says, meaning something abnormal, the structural and functional deviations from the normal that constitute disease or characterize a particular disease. When actually what's happening, or certainly what happened with myself, for example, is I was having a very normal reaction to a very abnormal situation. The way we pathologize women who are having very real and perfectly normal and logical responses to highly stressful situations, it really is a problem, and it's an issue, and it's one that causes a lot of controversy. Dr. Jess Taylor has suffered a lot of disrespect and abuse just for even opening that narrative. It really does force you to think. I'd put down some notes just of things to trauma. Some of our immediate reactions to trauma can be numbness and detachment, anxiety, severe fear, guilt, anger, sadness, depersonalization, denial, feeling overwhelmed. It can affect our cognitive reaction going through abuse. It can distort time, distort space, affect our memories. These are normal reactions to trauma that are very, very well documented and written about. So if we know that these are normal reactions to trauma, and we know that somebody has experienced trauma, that diagnosis can and is often made at a time when someone has not even begun to process the trauma that they've been through, and then can be used against women. The other thing that happens is when women have that label, for example, that the personality disorder I'll use for the sake of this conversation, often what happens is perpetrators will use these symptoms and these labels against their victims. So when a victim dares speak out about abuse, a perpetrator, and this is very common, will let the authorities know, oh, this person has a personality disorder. And they will do that to undermine and weaken their statements and ultimately get cases thrown out. There are women that then will lose their children because of these labels of mental illness. There are women that lose jobs, that are stigmatized for the rest of their lives. And I believe that's happening to a lot of women. And the solution is always to medicate them. Label and medicate, not actually deal with the issue, which is their processing trauma.
Yeah. Well, if I may, I have a lot of respect for what you're saying. In the work that I do, I would argue that so much of the issues that you're describing are presented by the way mental illnesses are treated. So
yeah,
trauma responses can be understood via the lens of diagnosable mental illnesses that become pathways to treatment in our current mental health system. And so I totally agree that something like PTSD can be so understandable via people's experiences of trauma that is a part of our brains attempting to process something, a situation we should have never been in, a lack of safety that we weren't prepared for, and therefore that had a lasting impact on our ability to process that trauma. If we are then mistreated for that perfectly human reaction, that's where I think it's disgusting.
The problem, right?
You know, in the same way, demonizing someone's upset, they cry, and that's demonized. Somebody's been, you know, failed by the justice system and they're angry and they might be demonized. You know, so much of this stigma is very dangerous to people and can leave people feeling that their problems aren't real. Whereas to me, I would argue that the diagnosis in itself, certainly for a lot of people, can be a very powerful acknowledgement of how real your experience is. I've talked about it many times. Getting diagnoses myself was an acknowledgement that there is something clear and identifiable that I'm going through, and that I'm not alone in it, and that many people have experienced depression and anorexia, and that there is treatment specifically for these experiences.
For those things.
You recommended the writing of Dr. Jess Taylor to me, and what she says is so fascinating, and I absolutely agree in how women are at times over-pathologized, mistreated for, you know, certain mental illnesses. Certain things like personality disorders are stigmatized still in so many ways. you know, and have not made as much progress in terms of being normalized in the way that other mental illnesses have. I don't agree with some of the conclusions that she makes about that being an argument that mental illness isn't real.
No, see, I don't think that she's necessarily saying mental illness isn't real. I think she wants to create a narrative where we're looking at, are these symptoms symptomatic of a label that has to permanently exist for somebody? As you are now this. This is you for the rest of your life. You have that. As opposed to letting that person know you're having a normal response. Now, just to clarify, I'm not anti-labels and I'm not anti-diagnosis at all. For me, I found particularly the diagnosis for the depression and anxiety, it was kind of like this moment of, oh, I'm not crazy. These things are real. This label actually essentially is something that describes and explains a group of symptoms that were very, very real and that I was experiencing. And I still do sometimes now. So I think having diagnosis and the labelling can be a huge relief, like you said, and can allow you to have a bit of understanding and empathy for yourself. But I do think there are conversations to be had which are very uncomfortable and are very controversial around how and when those labels become detrimental, because they can be incredibly helpful and useful and can lead on to paths to treatment and ultimately towards resolving those issues and maintaining a much better quality of life and to be able to really move forward. But there are also sadly times where those labels are used to people's detriment. And I think it's essential that those conversations are had so that people can actually start to be honest about what it means to be diagnosed for individuals. This is another big reason as to why many, many people do not engage with the mental health system. Because again, they don't want the stigma of a label, which is silly because like you said, in understanding and having that label, you can start to move towards
treatment. I don't think it's silly. I think the stigma is silly. You know, the fact that anyone should be in the position where they feel unable to get the support, because what will the support, what will the diagnosis mean for how other people treat me? You know, I think ultimately a lot of this comes down to the way labels are treated by others. And absolutely, you're so right that a big part of this is, I do believe we should all, you know, we can all reserve the right to have our own reaction to diagnosis. Yeah. You know, and so the perspectives can vary widely and should be discussed. For example, we've discussed on the pod with, you know, eating disorders. Anorexia is one that I have experience of. For me, I understand it via the lens of that is something that will always be a part of my experience. There are certain behaviors that I have learned through that mental illness that I can't unlearn, that if I am in, you know, a certain set of circumstances, or if my health deteriorates in certain ways, I may then readopt behaviors that I know and that I've had in the past in a way that if I hadn't ever had these experiences, I wouldn't have that to fall back to. Do you know what I mean? Within the concept of like the recovery model. And so for me, it's very helpful to view it in that way of like ongoing looking after myself. So whilst there's differing levels of how, you know, anorexic I might feel, it's going to be a factor in my long-term health. But then absolutely, I'm reminded of a friend, Jenny Pusey, who's been on the podcast, where she got to a point in her mental health recovery where her doctor told her she no longer fit the criteria for the personality disorder that she'd been diagnosed with. So even though, yes, these can be kind of seen as there not being a clear solution, that doesn't mean there isn't a way past the label. Do you see what I mean? So I'm glad there is the questioning of it. And I think we're pretty on the same page in a lot of this.
Yeah, I think so. My thing is just, I think it's just important to explore the conversation, but that doesn't mean necessarily that my opinions on the topic are fixed. But this is a topic that hasn't been explored enough. So it's very difficult to form fixed opinions on something that has been such a taboo for so long to actually talk about, and obviously is controversial and triggering for a lot of people. I think that the conversation around labels, probably in my own personal conversation with people, is one that causes the most discourse and the most discomfort, which to me tells me more of those conversations need to be had so that they're not so uncomfortable for people.
Yeah, because there absolutely should be a line of questioning that exists of people being over-pathologized. Absolutely. Yeah. And it doesn't take away that because people can be over-diagnosed with certain conditions, that at times very much falls along gender lines, because people can be so often misdiagnosed, as people hear from my guests on the podcast all the time, that doesn't invalidate your diagnosis being real. You know, it's still everybody's experience is different.
That, I couldn't have put it better. Yeah.
Thank you. And so as we start to wrap up then, I'm also very keen to talk to you about poetry, because I was saying to you off air, so often people list journaling as something that's been really transformational for their mental health. And a lot of the time it is presented as getting those thoughts out, getting them on paper, getting them, you know, getting the swirling thoughts into words and sentences can just help release a lot of the tension and make something on a page feel a lot more tackleable than the swirling, overwhelming thoughts in your head. And I felt like you, of all people, would have even more ways of explaining how putting things into words can be so transformational.
Well, I do have I don't know what the word is, but to quote myself, but I wrote about this in a poem last year, and I think it sums up how I feel about it. I'm not going to do the poem, but I'll quote. My pen is a healer. Given a blank page, it finds a safe space to channel rage and express pain, to explore time and space, love, inner knowing and faith. A blank page is a place of no shame, somewhere you can go to process emotion in silence, a place that you can meditate, say what you have to say without having to defend or explain. See, a page doesn't talk back to you, Bobby. It doesn't have an opinion, doesn't offer you unsolicited advice. And for me, I've had a lot of therapy over the years, but I can honestly say, in my own personal experience, writing and expressing myself in poetry has been the most healing and impactful thing for me in my process of recovery. I found myself using it as a personal tool for many years. So I knew the impact it had for me personally. But then a friend of mine back in 2017 said to me, oh, would you do a therapeutic poetry workshop for me? And I was very reluctant, very, very reluctant. I was like, I'm not qualified to do that, and I can't be doing that. And I really resisted it. And I finally did it. And every single person in that room that came, and it was a simple workshop on using poetry as a tool for self-expression. Half of the room cried, but they reassured me it was cathartic and they felt good for it. And everyone left asking me when the next one was. So it was never my plan to launch Poetry Prescribed, which is the service that I offer to people. And it happened very much organically, but it has grown into something so, so powerful. And I'm really, really lucky to be able to use my love of writing to support and help others. So essentially, I got into this. And as I got into it, I was thinking, well, why is this having such a huge impact? We're meeting and we're writing together and we're talking, and I'm just guiding people through this writing process, and they're telling me it helps. And then I really got into looking into some of the incredible research that there is, and there's lots. If you just Google poetry and mental health, you'll find so, so many papers. It relieves depressive symptoms. It can improve your self-esteem. It can inspire your creativity. I think it definitely promotes personal growth. The amount of times I've written something, and we say, yeah, it feels better when you write about it, and it does. I do this thing called time traveling with my poetry. Sometimes I'll go back to something I wrote a year ago, and I'll realize, oh, there's something in that for now. There's something in that that I didn't realize that was going to help this version of me. It's been shown to alleviate anxiety. And the biggest thing that I've noticed with it when I work with groups is its ability to promote empathy amongst people and understanding. In not just writing poetry, but in listening to someone else's story, listening to someone else's poetry. It can give you a deeper understanding and it's relatable. And sometimes just the amount of times I've performed a poem and someone's contacted me and said, thank you so much. You made me feel seen. You know, I feel understood. That in itself is so powerful. I've done all sorts of poetry prescribed. I've worked in education. I've worked with community mental health services. I've worked with young people. I've worked with female survivors. And it can help people tap into nonverbal responses. It can help people feel in the same way that music does sometimes. And I've seen it time and time again where I've had people that are not able to articulate their own experiences or talk openly about their own experiences. Let's take anxiety, for example. And then I'll perform or share a poem about anxiety and I'll invite discussion about the poem, not about your personal experience. And it allows people the freedom and the space and the safety to talk about the issue without necessarily making it personal to them. Inevitably, what tends to happen in my workshops is people then do feel safer and more secure to talk about their own experience, but poetry becomes the catalyst for that conversation. And it's just the most incredible thing to see. I just worked with a woman's group. We have a book coming out actually in March of all the poetry they've written in my workshop. And after the second week, and none of these women have got writing experience, none of them are poets, but they come to a workshop and I'll stimulate the discussion or the conversation on particular topics and guide them through writing process, teach them how to free write, different ways in which you can approach writing, even if you're not a writer. And I give them those techniques. And I had a woman after 2 weeks come back to me and say, I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning with my panic attacks again and unsettled, but I managed to go back to sleep before five. I said, what happened? She said, you know, I wrote, I sat and I did your free writes and I wrote. And afterwards I slept like a baby. And I just thought, wow, this is what it can do for people. And by no means is poetry, you know, the answer and the only and even a therapy, but it definitely has therapeutic value, huge therapeutic value. So yeah, that's something that I think I will always be passionate about, is introducing people to poetry and writing as a tool to support, at least support mental health and well-being.
Yeah, well, even that, you know, I respect your work so much, so I even want to push back on that. It may not be the answer for everyone, but it's clearly been such a big part of the answer for you. And the other things I want to pick up there is I love the concept of time traveling with it. I've never like conceptualized it in that way, but that's wonderful. And I guess, you know, that's something I get the privilege to do through my work, that, you know, every so often we like re-release episodes or I go back and revisit, you know, often if I'm re-interviewing someone, I listen to the previous interview. And, you know, often there are those nerves of being aware that you're constantly kind of evolving in how you approach your work. And therefore, me going back a few years, I might think, oh God, I'm a bit nervous to hear how I am on this interview.
Yeah.
And it's lovely to go back and be like, you know what, I'm still me. And, you know, I forgot that I'd spoken about that thing. Or, you know, in that week I shared how I was really struggling with something. Or I, you know, I'm listening to it and I'm like, oh, I really should have asked this question. And then I hear myself ask that exact question a few seconds later. And so for me, there's that reassurance of through time, you're still you. And, you know, there's value and there's insight across the spectrum of your life when so often we can, you know, all be a bit guilty of thinking, oh, we're constantly hustling, we're constantly working towards being the version of ourselves that we want to be. But, you know, we are ourselves and we are present on that entire journey. So I love that. I also love what you said about how it starts conversations, because what it made me think about is how it gives people language when so often mental health is hardly talked about. Having the conversations can give people words that they've never had. And that cannot be, and you know, overappreciated to me.
Yeah, and just going back to what you said about, I've never really looked at it like that, actually, of time traveling to understand, oh, I've always been this version of me. There might have been layers or things around me, but I've always been her or I've always been him. I've always used it to measure my progress, because sometimes, especially when you're in recovery, and it can be a long process, recovery sometimes, you don't feel like you've made that much progression. So for me, I go back sometimes and read that poetry from 10 years ago and I'm like, oh my gosh, look how far you've come. And it allows me to take pride in my journey. It allows me to be forgiving of all of the things that perceivably I haven't done yet, or all of the way that I feel. I mean, sometimes we're so focused on where we're going that we don't stop to be in the present and think, actually, where I am now is great. Look how far you've traveled. And going back to those earlier poems allows me the space to be a bit kinder to myself.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And so on that note of being reminded to all be kinder to ourselves, I think we'll wrap up there. If people want to find your wonderful work, where should they go?
Everything is on www.missyankey.com, Yankey.
The efficiency.
You'll find everything.
Yeah. And I can make it even more efficient for you. You don't even need the www.
Oh, I don't. I could just say missyankey.com.
That's back from the internet dark ages where it would only search the entire internet if you prompted it to with that. And now it just does. We're so interconnected. And we're going to play out today's episode with an incredible poem by Miss Yankey called Stop It, which touches on so much that it definitely touches on a lot of what we've talked about today. And I think really kind of sums up a lot of the challenges of where we're at with mental health. So, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
There's a war in my community, but we've lost sight of the enemy. So much time stuck inside our screens that we're numb to these bloody streets. Another stabbing in the news, another story misconstrued. The media are lacking truth, got you desensitized to bleeding youths. Out here profiting from children's deaths, while broken-hearted mothers lay their sons to rest. One boy tried to save his brother on his chest he pressed, whilst people stood around and filmed his final breath. Snaps, posts and twisted tweets viewed like they are movie scenes, adults clicking share when they should delete. The youth are spilling blood and you're spilling tea. I see you shaking heads and talking shit like, that could never be my kid like, his mama should have given him licks like, you even care who his mama is. There are youths who feel they have no choice, but their experience is null and void. If they dare to dream, then it's soon destroyed. And the same youths are left without a voice. And even when they ask for help, we don't listen. How can you find a cure if you don't clock the symptoms? We sit and watch and suffer in a broken system and then complain about a broken Britain. Politicians say the youth are lost, but they keep cutting down on crucial costs. And I swear they lost the fucking plot. Spending Peter Print on a chicken box? I once heard that if the circumstance was right, then anyone could take a life, and there is no such thing as a criminal mind, only a set of factors that can drive a crime. Housing sector? Funding cuts. Social care? Funding cuts. Mental health? Funding cuts. Police force? Funding cuts. Education? Funding cuts. Youth clubs? Funding cuts. Homelessness? The streets are lined. Child poverty on the rise. Mental illness? Huge increase. Stop and search? Fuck the police. School to prison? Pipelines climb. Youth on road? Numbers up. Austerity is killing us. But I guess it's easier for us to blame the youth than it is for us to face the truth. The truth hurts. Our youth hurt. Our youth deserve better from us. So stop it. Victim blaming and shaming, stop it. Ignoring their voices and limiting their choices, stop it. Denying their experiences and denying their pain, stop it. Allowing the police to violate their human rights, stop it. Supporting racist media who stereotype, stop it. Not holding the government accountable, stop it. You need to stop it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, You are enough.